running nowhere. He gives me a short nod and jumps down from the train car. Hey! At least leave the keys so I can unlock Kate. The keys fly backward over his shoulder, and I snatch them out of the air. I unlock Catherine's chains and help her to her feet. Ugh, you smell, she says, holding the back of her hand delicately to her face. You ain't a bed of roses yourself. I jerk my head toward the opening. Come on. I want to see what they do to old Muttonhead. We jump down from the rail car, unsteady after so many days locked up. Catherine and I are just in time to see Jackson tackled by the three men, a little ways down the street that leads away from the rail yard. Mr. Redfern runs down to help, and I cross my arms and watch as the scene unfolds. Catherine frowns.
Well, that wasn't wise.
Nope.
Jackson struggles against the men, finally slumping in their arms after Mr. Redfern gives him a little payback by way of a fist to the chin.
What was that boy thinking?
Catherine murmurs, shaking her head.
I wonder as well.
Jackson's had run-ins with the mayor's men before. What does he expect in a place like this? The West is lawless as all get out from what the papers say. I doubt a town founded by Baltimore's no-good mayor and his survivalist pals is going to be much better.
Do you think they'll kill him?
Nah, not yet.
At least I hope not.
I am not proud to say. It gives me a perverse kind of joy to see Jackson take a few licks. After all, it's mostly his fault I'm here in the first place. Him and those damn blue-green eyes. They went through a lot of trouble to bring us all this way. We're needed for something, so I don't think they're going to be so quick to kill us right yet. The men pick Jackson up and haul him toward a wooden front building with bars on the windows. I ain't sure if the bars are meant to keep the shamblers out or people in. My accommodations didn't exactly give me the bird's eye view of the town, and what I'm seeing now is just mystifying. Everything here is new. The buildings ain't anything like I'd imagined in a frontier town. Everything is whitewashed, and a boardwalk runs along the front of the buildings, raising the foot traffic above the dusty main street. I spy a saloon, bank, dry goods store, and a hotel. The road is flat and well-maintained, and beyond the town is the flattest land I've ever seen. There's a cluster of houses off in the distance, but there's no telling how big they are or if they're even occupied. The plains are golden yellow, fading into a sky so pale it's like a sun-bleached version of the sky back in Maryland. It's hotter than Hades, and the sun beats down mercilessly. Far off, there's a strange ridge, even and uniform, and I can't make out what it is even as I squint against the sun. Catherine shades her eyes and looks around.
Oh, my. Is that a barrier wall?
She points in the same direction as the ridge, and I shake my head.
It can't be. A wall that large? How could they maintain it?
Mr. Redfern returns to where Catherine and I stand, and he gives us a quick bow.
My apologies, ladies, I snort.
You kidnapped us and dragged us to the middle of nothing, and you're apologizing for putting a hurting on Jackson?
You're a strange man, Mr. Redfern. He gives me what I've come to think of as his death glare and turns to Catherine.
If you would please follow me, Sheriff Snyder is waiting to meet you,
he says,
completely ignoring me.
We make our way down the street, our passage kicking up dust that coats my skin and clogs my nostrils. If I didn't feel like a mess before, the short walk to the sheriff's office from the rail station definitely does the trick. In Baltimore, the roads are all cobblestone, civilized, and clean.
Even the country roads around Miss Preston's are a dirt so hard-packed that they might as well be stone. But even though the street here looks lovely from far off, close up the pockmarks reveal themselves. Large piles of something that looks suspiciously like feces dots the lane. I pointed out to Catherine, raising my eyebrows. She shrugs.
It's horse manure,
Mr. Redfern answers out of nowhere, and both Catherine and I look at him in disbelief.
Horses? Catherine asks. You have horses?
I squeak. I've never seen a horse, apart from paintings of them. Great beasts that people once rode before the shamblers made them a ready food source. The iron ponies replaced horses as transportation, and I'd love nothing more than to see a horse up close. Mama used to talk about her favorite horse, Cassandra, named after some doomed woman from ancient myth. Apparently the name was prophetic. The first time Rose Hill was hit with a wave of shamblers, they went after the horses, tearing into the poor beasts before Mama and Josiah, the big dark man who led the field work, could put them down. It was a small group, and we were lucky. It gave us enough warning to prepare for future attacks. Most of Rose Hill's neighbors weren't so fortunate. Next to me, Catherine sighs.
I'd love to see a horse.
I nod. Me too. Mr. Redfern gives us a bit of side eye.
Well, you'll get your wish. They ride horses along the perimeter fence. I don't know what the sheriff has planned for you, but it will probably include some patrols. There aren't nearly enough bodies to fill them properly.
There's something behind his expression that tells me there is more to his words than he's letting on. But I'll leave it alone for now. We stopped short outside of a building with a large, fancy, hand-lettered glass window proclaiming sheriff and a flag of red and white stripes. Survivalists. Mr. Redfern holds the door open for us, and Catherine and I file into a plain-looking office.
Good luck,
he says under his voice before falling in behind us. What he means by that, I can't know, but his tone is earnest. Even with the large front window, the room is gloomy. It takes a few moments for my eyes to adjust, and when they do, the vague shapes form into a desk, some chairs, and a cell along the back wall that is currently occupied by Jackson. The whole place carries the smell of unwashed bodies and tobacco smoke, with a faint air of decay. The walls are bare wood, with notices breaking up the empty space. A large sign proclaiming, no drinking after 8, a weekly prayer meeting schedule, 2 sets of town laws, one for coloreds and another for whites, and most curious of all, a long document labeled, the Summerland Bill of Rights, posted right next to the door.
These the girls the mayor wired me about?
Catherine and I halt at the deep voice, and a loud thump follows, the sound of boots hitting the wide plank floor. I'm half wondering where they got all of this wood from. I ain't seen a single tree around here, just that golden grass and flat landscape. Did the mayor bring all this building material west on the train? No wonder he was carrying on about investors. Behind us, Mr. Redfern clears his throat.
Yes, Sheriff. Jane McKean and Catherine Devereaux, both recent graduates of Miss Preston's School of Combat for Negro Girls. That'll be all, Redskin. Tell Bob and William they need to come back to escort these two after I'm done talking with them. Of course.
Mr. Redfern's voice is tight, but a glance over my shoulder reveals nothing, his face impassive. I know he has to be hot over being called Redskin like that, which is an insult in the highest degree. After all, his skin isn't even red, but his expression is mild. I sure wouldn't want to play poker with Mr. Redfern. The door opens and closes as Mr. Redfern departs, and I turn my attention to the sheriff. The white man who stands before us has the reddened skin of someone who has spent many long days in the shadeless sun of these plains. He wears a wide-brim hat, even though we're indoors, and I figure that a place as lawless as this probably ain't got much use for manners. His sandy mustache droops on either side of his mouth, and despite his relative youth, his movements as he sits are slow and deliberate. I suppose he would be considered attractive, yet there's something I don't like about him. There's a spark in his blue eyes that makes me think the man is more dangerous than he looks. The way they say gators in the swamps down south pretend to be logs before taking a bite out of a man. This is a man who likes to be underestimated.
Jane McKean, your reputation precedes you.
Well, sir, I don't see how that could be. I'm nobody.
A nobody who makes the front page of the Sun.
The man reaches back on his desk and grabs a news sheet. It's the paper from nearly a month ago. The date puts it the day after the lecture, and the headline reads, Mayor and the Missus Saved by Negro Girls Daring Do. The illustration that accompanies the story is a crudely drawn version of me, my hair sticking up in 20 different directions, my lips thick and my eyes wild as I gun down no fewer than 10 shamblers. Sheriff Snyder, I must confess, this is the first time I've seen such a headline. Might I borrow your news sheet to peruse the story at my leisure? An expression I can't identify crosses his face.
You read?
There's a sudden tension in the room, and I hunch my shoulders and shuffle a bit, letting a slow drawl enter my voice. I prefer to be misjudged as well.
No, sir, I say, my words slow and deliberate. I'd just like to look at the pictures, if and that's okay.
The sheriff hands me the newspaper with a grunt before leaning back against the desk and crossing his arms, and I tuck the paper into the top of my boot while the man talks.
So, the ground rules. Curfew at 8 each night unless you're assigned to a patrol. You will be responsible for the protection of this town. Scythe, sickle, knife, club, you want it, you got it. But no guns. We don't let the darkies carry 'em, only my boys. I used to run patrols back in Georgia before the war, and I know how crafty you people can be.
The sheriff's voice goes hard, and I swallow. He takes out a pouch of tobacco and begins to roll a cigarette as he continues.
You ain't slaves, because as far as I know, that's still illegal, more's the pity. So you'll be paid $2 a week plus your room and board. You also get a bath once a week, should you choose to use it. I know your kind have an aversion to water.
Catherine and I exchange a look. Who is this man? And just how many Negroes does he know?
Also, no drinking and no fornication. Summerland is a town of high morals, so none of that will be tolerated. Breaking my rules results in swift penalties. Do you understand?
For a moment, the world falls away and I can see the future as it opens up before me. Toiling away, working in the fields or on patrols, killing the dead while people like the sheriff live a life of safety and leisure. On the surface, it seems to be equal to my potential future in Baltimore, but there I still had a choice. Well, at least the pretense of one. It always seemed I could strike out on my own should I choose to leave Miss Preston's. It would have been an ill-advised choice, but an option nonetheless. Here, there's not even the subterfuge of such a possibility. The trap is sprung well and tight. I know what things were like before the war between the states, and even though the years after were chaotic, at least colored folks like me were free. But this place is the brainchild of a bunch of survivalists, built on a dream of pre-war America, which is how I know that my next words will change everything. Sir, I say, I ain't sure why you're making Miss Catherine listen to all this. She ain't a Negro. The sheriff turns to me as Catherine's eyes go wide. Behind me, his men shift. I've gotten their attention. Jane, Catherine says, fists clenched, color riding high in her cheeks. What are you? It ain't your fault the mayor put you to the side, Miss Catherine. Ain't your fault at all. And I know you's about to be cross with me, but you can't toil in the field. You're better than that. Catherine buries her face in her hands. I ain't sure whether she's laughing or crying, but I use the moment to finish my plan before she can ruin it. I step closer to the desk. I graduated from Miss Preston's. That's the Lord's own truth, sure. But Miss Catherine here is a lady. My charge. The mayor took a fancy to Miss Catherine, and his old windbag of a wife conspired to have her sent here. That's why she's dressed like an attendant. She was tricked. Catherine is now staring daggers at me as the sheriff turns to her, a glint of interest in his eye.
That true? He asks.
Catherine turns her head, refusing to meet the sheriff's eyes, her lips clamped shut. Even after 5 days of rough treatment, she's still beautiful, which is how I know this is going to work. The sheriff turns to Jackson, who's sat up enough to watch the goings-on in the office.
You there, boy. This woman white, or is she a darkie?
Jackson's jaw clenches. He looks the sheriff in the eye, and slow as winter molasses draws out,
She definitely ain't a darkie.
The door opens behind me. The sheriff looks over my shoulder and says,
Go fetch the professor. Tell him I need him to bring his tools.
I look over my shoulder as one of the men that waited for the rail car nods and ducks back out of the door. The other man leers at me, and I just give him a flat stare in return. I'm tense from the ride, and I'd like an opportunity to knock some sense into one of these boys. The sheriff sighs.
We got ways of figuring out whether or not someone's colored, never you fear. We'll table that discussion until the professor gets here. So, as I was saying, Summerland is a town of high morals. Church every Sunday, a dance the last Saturday of every month, providing there's been no infractions. Bible study on Wednesdays and Fridays. The pastor seems to think the word of the Lord will keep your kind in line, but I ain't so sure.
He mutters as he licks the rolling paper, sealing his cigarette closed. He lights the thing, and blue-gray smoke fills the room. I say nothing, but Catherine looks like she's about to cry. The sheriff has taken every opportunity to insult us and remind us of the circumstance of our dark skin, and I'd like nothing more than to tell him what I think. I can take down a pack of shamblers like nobody's business. I am clever and can work my way out of any bad situation. I know I am more than my skin color, but there's nothing to be gained by an outburst right now. I need to get the lay of the land and figure out how to get myself a few hundred miles east in one piece.
Oh, and one last thing,
the sheriff says as the door opens behind us.
You step out of line, and you'll find yourself swiftly reminded of your place.
A tall white boy wearing a bowler, a blue waistcoat, and a white shirt with the sleeves rolled up to his forearms, pushes past me and Catherine. The sheriff looks at him and puffs on his cigarette.
About time. This one says she ain't colored. I need you to measure her up. And you can use the other one as a test subject for your new experiment.
Sheriff, how many times do I have to ask that you send them down to the lab? I can't do anything here, and it takes a while to distill the vaccine.
The boy turns around and I realize he's older than I first thought. Maybe early 20s, with stubble darkening his cheeks. He ain't handsome, but there's something indescribably appealing about his face. He's pale, not sickly, but like he doesn't get out in the sun much. His dark brows are pulled together in a scowl, and his muddy hazel eyes dart around the room like he's calculating something. There's an intelligence there that draws me in. I don't much mind looking at him, even though he's probably a rat bastard since he's working with the sheriff. The sheriff, for his part, just continues to puff on his cigarette.
Fine. Take them to that hole of yours. I don't need your back talk.
Of course. The boy's words are clipped. He might still be a bastard, but I'd wager he doesn't like the lawman too much, which maybe counts for something. The sheriff doesn't seem to detect the tone, though. He kicks his feet up onto the desk, leaning back in his chair with a smile.
Welcome to Summerland, girls. Try not to die before I can replace you.
Jane, I hope that while you are away, you are keeping in mind all the things that I have taught you. We live in very troubling times, but that is still no excuse not to be a lady. Always mind your manners. Chapter 18. In which my reputation is slandered. As the nameless boy turns to me and Catherine, his expression softens.
Would you ladies please follow me? I'll need to take you to my lab.
Before I can exit, the fellow behind me gives me a none too gentle shove with the barrel of his gun, and I turn and give him my best side eye. Sir, please refrain from the liberal use of your rifle. Otherwise, I will show you some creative places to put it. The man just gives me a gap-toothed grin full of malice, and we make our way out of the sheriff's office and back onto the boardwalk, the pale, dark-haired boy leading the way. As he walks, his left foot drags a little. I wonder how he got such a limp, if he was born with it or if something bad happened to him when he was young. I reckon we all have our childhood scars, whether we wear them on the outside or not. The man behind me shoves me with the rifle barrel again, this time causing me to stumble. I catch myself against the front of the general store as he chuckles.
What are you gonna do? Nothing, that's what, you uppity darky? You ain't in no position to be giving me any lip.
I smile sweetly at him as a black temper sweeps over me. All of the indignities of the past few days coalescing into a dark cloud that erases all thought. Then I center myself and, quick as you please, drop into a crouch and whip around to sweep his legs out from under him. Once he's on the ground, I kick him in the side before placing my knee on his throat. All of this happens in less than a rabbit's heartbeat. As he gurgles and flails, I lean in close. Right now, sir, with my knee on your throat, I am in the perfect position to counsel you on your bad manners. A lesson to be learned. Lady Fortune is as fickle as they come. And in a land full of shamblers, you best not test my good nature. You hear me? You never know when you'll end up with the bite. The sound of a revolver cocking is deafening next to my ear.
Miss, would you please get off of Bill? I'm afraid he's the sheriff's cousin, and the sheriff would be quite upset if anything happened to him.
I glance back to see the pale boy above us, the lovely Colt in his hand pointed straight at my head. I give him my sweetest smile and climb to my feet. Of course. I even bob a little curtsy. The boy puts his revolver away, tucking it back into the holster that hangs low on his hips.
And, Bill, please show some restraint. These ladies are trained in the art of killing the dead. I know you haven't heard of Miss Preston's, but the girls from that school are well respected. They are a far cry from the Negroes we get from the southern enclaves. It would be a small matter for them to turn that talent on you. Bill picks up his hat off the ground and spits.
I don't take orders from you, boy.
No, you don't. But you do need someone to treat that malady of yours. So I would caution you to check your baser impulses, sir. It is a delicate procedure, and Doc has been known to have shaky hands when he doesn't get his whiskey.
And like I tell the good doctor often, you never know when the town might suddenly go dry.
Bill goes whiter than a sheet, and I can't help but wonder what kind of treatment he needs, and what might make a man so fearful of a pair of shaky hands. The boardwalk ends, and we step into the dusty street and keep walking. Bill falls back a little, probably worried that I'll feed him my foot again. No chance of that, not in these shoes. My feet hurt. And I think longingly of my boots back at Miss Preston's, worn in and so very comfortable. Me and Catherine still wear our finery from the night we were shanghaied, and these things I'm wearing are for looking pretty, not strolling through a frontier town.
Hey there, Gideon. You bringing me some new girls?
A woman hangs out of a doorway across the street. It takes everything I have to keep my mouth from dropping open in shock. The woman is generously appointed, her white bosom spilling out over the top of her low-cut gray gown, her hand on one of her wide hips. Her hair is red as cherries and piled messily on top of her head. Behind her, a few other women peek out into the street, everyone trying to get an eyeful. The pale boy, who I am supposing is named Mr. Gideon, stops and tips his bowler.
Good day to you, Duchess. I'm afraid at least one of these girls is headed to the patrols, and neither are intended for employment in your fine establishment.
The women in the doorway all titter at Mr. Gideon's pretty words, and as we continue walking, Catherine leans in close to my ear.
I do believe that is a house of ill repute.
I nod solemnly.
Yes, Kate, I do believe you are correct.
Catherine sniffs.
I cannot believe she thinks we're meant to work there.
I stare at Catherine, trying to figure out if she's serious or having to go at me. Her expression is that of someone who has suffered a grievous insult, and I have to fight to swallow a hysterical laugh. Her mouth drops open.
Jane, tell me you aren't insulted.
I lean in close so that the men don't hear me.
Insulted?
Kate, we have been put in chains and sent halfway across the continent. We are currently at the mercy of a man who believes that Negroes are put here on this earth to fight shamblers at the white man's behest, and is going to send us out to do it without guns. Jackson sits in a jail cell awaiting some unknown fate. This town is a dirt spot in the middle of nowhere. There are no trees, and the land is disconcertingly flat. My virtue is honestly the last thing I'm worried about. I'm hungry, tired, a little afraid, and a whole bunch angry, but a few hurt feelings are the furthest thing from my mind right now. My voice rises as I talk, and by the time I get to the end, Mr. Gideon has turned around.
Don't worry, Miss Devereaux. The Duchess just likes to have some sport with all the girls that come through. Her sense of humor tends a bit mean. Members of the patrol may spend their sleep shifts under the roof of her saloon, but no one in this town will believe they are doing anything but resting there. I've taken steps to ensure that past mistakes are not repeated.
I force him a tight-lipped smile, but his words only serve to agitate me further. Every minute in this place reveals a new, terrible fact. Past mistakes! He doesn't elaborate, and we finally reach his hole, as the sheriff called it. It's a small building,
not much bigger than the privies we passed a little ways back, and Gideon turns to Bill when we arrive.
You can stay here. I'll be back in a few minutes.
Bill says nothing, jaw tight, but takes up a guard position while Catherine and I follow Mr. Gideon down into the gloom. The most distressing change here at Rose Hill is that, due to the undead plague, most of the people in the valley have abandoned their farms for easier living out west. I dare say that if it weren't for the aunties, even our happy community would be torn asunder. But Auntie Aggie and her sisters have proven to be as wise as ever, and we are living still in relative comfort. Chapter 19. In which I am vaccinated and become a beacon of hope. The narrow staircase is dark, but a yellow glow from up ahead provides a bit of illumination. I walk behind Catherine, my fingers brushing hard-packed earth on either side. The staircase ends and deposits us in a sizable room. The walls and floors are buttressed like a basement, and the entire space is much larger than the small building we entered. Catherine is looking around the room, her expression filled with wonder, and it's no surprise. We are in a genuine laboratory. One of the weeklies a few months ago had been about a scientist who went mad, turning himself into a terrible creature that ravished women. The scientist eventually kills himself after he sees the horror he hath wrought. And I think that, had the story been real, this is the kind of place that might have been his lair. Small lights are embedded into the ceiling, but I find it hard to believe there might be gas lines in this hellscape. Beakers and bits of metalwork are strewn across a wooden workbench, and there are a number of strange, shiny steel things that I reckon are weapons along one wall.
What kind of place is this?
Catherine breathes. She's just as awed as I am. I ain't never seen something so amazing. And I'm half afraid that this ain't real, just a fever dream from being locked up in that rail car.
It's my lab. I'm responsible for a lot of the technology you'll see around Summerland. Electric lights, he says, pointing to the ceiling. Some of the farming equipment we use. I designed a lot of the weaponry. It's my job here. You heard the sheriff up there. Everyone in Summerland has their place, and it's important to remember what it is.
There's a tone in his voice. And I wonder if Mr. Gideon ain't here by choice any more than me and Catherine. He sighs and waves us over to a workbench along the back wall. A dozen different pieces lie across the surface, and he holds up a sharp needle attached to a glass vial.
Every Negro who comes to Summerland gets vaccinated. The purpose is simple. The vaccination keeps you from turning if you get bit while on patrol.
I roll my eyes.
Right.
His eyebrows raise.
You don't believe me?
While in Baltimore, I had the benefit of attending a lecture given by a professor named Gehring. You heard of him?
Mr. Gideon puts down the syringe and crosses his arms.
I have. Well, I say, bending down to take the sheriff's newspaper from the top of my boot, I happened to kill the man the professor termed after his vaccine failed. Professor Gehring was no Louis Pasteur, I can tell you that. You can ask my Miss Catherine. She was there, too. I slipped back into the faithful servant act I put on for the sheriff for just a moment. I don't know this man, and I have to question the sanity of anyone who thinks sticking a needle in my neck is a good idea. Mr. Gideon turns to Catherine, and she gives him a tight smile.
What Jane says is true. His vaccine didn't work.
Mr. Gideon gives me an appreciative smile.
Well, that doesn't surprise me at all. But this is my vaccine, not his, and I happen to know for certain that this is the genuine article.
Oh, you tested out on Negroes as well? I ask. the black feeling growing just a smidge. Despite his kindness, this man is just like the rest of his kind, polite until you tell them no.
You'll be the first. I tested it out on myself and a few unwilling cats. Now, please, let me finish vaccinating you. I assure you that it's perfectly safe. If you decide to put up any resistance, Bill back there would be happy to assist. I'm sure a lady of your bearing would much rather face adversity with her head held high than in physical restraint. He takes a deep breath and lets it out. Please, I know what the sheriff has planned for you. It really is for your own good. I purse my lips to keep from telling him what I think of his assumption as to the nature of my character and inherent needs. I don't like the idea of that needle punching holes in me. But I ain't in any position to put up a real fight right now. I'm even more tired and hungry than when I got off the train, and I've no desire to get pummeled like poor Jackson. An uncertain future is still better than no future at all. Besides, I have yet to find a jam I can't get myself out of. One day this whole Summerland fiasco will just be an interesting footnote in the story of my life. I step forward, pulling down my collar so Mr. Gideon can stick the needle in the hollow of my neck. He pulls up the leather string with my lucky penny on it, a single eyebrow raised. Are you superstitious, Miss McKean? It's only superstition if you don't believe, Mr. Gideon. This close, his eyes are more green than brown, and they dance with humor as a smile quirks his lips.
Quite so, Miss McKean, quite so.
His hands are gentle, and the metal is cool as it pierces my skin.
Thank you, he says, his voice low.
It causes an odd shiver to go running down my spine, and I step backward a little too quickly, anxious to put some space between the two of us.
Now, Miss Devereaux, it seems the sheriff believes you to be a white woman. Why is that?
Mr. Gideon takes off his spectacles and wipes them with his pocket square. Catherine shoots me a glare.
Because someone told him I was.
Mr. Gideon nods.
Well, phrenologists claim we can identify someone's character and racial derivation by measuring the skull. He goes to a drawer and pulls out a set of calipers. I cough to cover my laughter. I'd been thinking Mr. Gideon was a fair sight smarter than the typical fellow in this place. But if he believes that he can tell anything by the size of someone's head, he's just as daft as the rest of them.
Catherine doesn't say anything, but Mr. Gideon is gentle as he takes several measurements and jots them in a notebook.
It looks like you're telling the truth, according to my calculations, Mr. Gideon says with a frown.
Hooray for science, I say. He shakes his head.
I don't believe in phrenology at all. It's easily disproven. The pet hobby of bigots.
I cross my arms. Kate is white.
Mr. Gideon gives me a tight-lipped smile. Well, it doesn't matter what I think. Pastor Snyder is the sheriff's father and the real power in town. The preacher makes the final decision on all matters. These numbers are for him.
So this town is a family business, then. Good to know.
What a degenerate group of kinfolk. No wonder they found themselves exiled to the middle of the continent.
Catherine gives me another dirty look while Mr. Gideon packs away his implements, and I shrug and give her an apologetic grin. I feel mighty bad about getting her shipped out west with me and Jackson. If I can make sure she can live here as a white lady, that should go a long way toward squaring us. I don't much care about Catherine, but I hate owing anyone anything, most especially someone as put together as her.
Mr. Gideon sighs, dragging my attention back to him. I'm sorry you find yourselves here, ladies. Truly I am. Now, if you'll follow me, we'll get you some clothing better suited to frontier life and some food. I expect you're both hungry and tired after your long trip. We both nod and follow Mr. Gideon up the stairs. Halfway out of his laboratory, Catherine grabs my wrist and gives me a proper glare.
I hope this thing about me being white is part of some grand scheme you have to get us out of this, she whispers.
Emotion is heavy in her voice, and I worry that she's about to break on me. I give her a saucy wink. No, I don't have any idea how we're going to get out of Summerland. But I'm a patient girl, and all I need is time.
Stepping back out into the sun after the cool shadows of Mr. Gideon's lab is like a punishment all its own.
Bill leans against the side of the small building that shelters the staircase, hat forward to keep the sun off of his face.
Ladies, Mr. Gideon says, tilting his bowler as he shows us out.
Bill startles awake, loosing a thick stream of tobacco juice in my direction. I manage to jump aside before it hits my fancy boots.
I bet you're a big hit with the ladies, I say.
He says nothing but just glares in my direction before yanking his head to the side.
Come on so we can get you outfitted. The sooner we get your black ass out to the border, the sooner you'll lose some of that sass.
I smile sweetly in Bill's direction as we follow him back to the general store. Bill is not the kind to open a door for a lady, so Catherine and I let ourselves in while he posts up next to the entryway, tilting his hat low again. The man behind the counter of the general store, a Mr. Washington, is kind and helpful and gives me two sets of loose-fitting trousers, two shirts of a rough material, a pair of sturdy boots that appear used, and a single set of underthings.
This is all you get for free. Anything else you have to buy. Shopping day for Negroes is Tuesday. Don't try to come round any other day than that. The sheriff will just have you thrown out. Also, you'll need to buy winter gear early. Last year I was clean out of coats come November, and I don't know where you're from, but January here is no joking matter.
You got anything nicer for Miss Kate? I say, raising my head defiantly.
Mr. Washington narrows his eyes at me.
That's all I got for clothing.
Catherine gives Mr. Washington a kind smile.
I apologize, sir. Jane is a good girl, but a bit protective, as an attendant should be. She meant to ask, do you have any clothes suitable for a lady?
Mr. Washington's expression softens, and he shakes his head, looking truly saddened.
No, miss, I'm afraid you'll have to see Mrs. Allen for that.
He moves away, and I lean into Catherine. At least it ain't striped, I say. She scowls at me, and I grin wide.
And hey, you stopped arguing about being white.
You better be right about this. I dislike lying.
It gets easier the more you do it. Mr. Washington comes back with a ledger and asks us to make our mark. I put an X where he indicates, while Catherine signs with a flourish. We thank Mr. Washington and carry our bundles out of the store. Bill stands when he sees us and gestures down the street.
You'll share a room with the rest of your kind above the Duchess's place. Sheriff won't send you out to the line today. He's a good Christian, and the pastor thinks even animals deserve a day off after the trip out here. You'll eat with the rest of the girls, patrol with them, what have you. For now, you'll use the weapons out on the line.
Bill spits again.
Try not to get yourselves killed too quickly. I bet Pete you girls would last to All Saints Day at least.
The door to the sheriff's office opens, and another of his flunkies walks toward us.
Pastor says the blonde one is white. Test checks out. We gotta walk her to the church. Other one can go on patrol, though.
Catherine stands up straighter.
I require my attendant by my side.
It isn't proper to be walking around unprotected.
Don't worry. We'll keep an eye on you,
the man says, giving Catherine a grin that makes me feel like I ate something foul. Not likely, I say, putting myself between Catherine and the man. It ain't proper, and I'm here to make sure Miss Catherine is cared for like the lady she is. I spread my feet in a defensive position. Attendants get training in hand-to-hand combat because the dead ain't the only threat to young ladies of good breeding. Besides, I'd like nothing more than to have a reason to break one of these fellas' faces.
Let the girl walk Miss Devereaux to the church. You know how the pastor feels about his ladies,
Bill says, voice low. He leers at Catherine for a moment before he leans in close to me.
I look forward to straightening out that sideways attitude of yours.
He and his friend walk off back toward the sheriff's office, leaving me and Catherine alone for the first time since we arrived in Summerland. She turns toward me, her expression impassive. Jane, I fear we have landed ourselves in a certifiably terrible place. A bubble of hysterical laughter threatens to well up, and I have to swallow it back down. What was your first clue? As I said earlier, I trust your devious brain is working through a way out of this pickle. This town is terrifying. I set off toward the church, Catherine yapping all the while. I ain't sure what to expect in Summerland's House of the Lord. Nothing good, though. Even under the best of circumstances, me and preachers don't mix so well. And these circumstances ain't anywhere near the neighborhood of good. Catherine and I both stink to high heaven, and I can't expect that a man of God will want to tolerate our stench any more than we do. As we walk, Catherine's voice is getting more and more hysterical. There's a separate shopping day for Negroes. I have been called a darky at least 4 times today, and I'm pretty sure that Bob called us animals. Bill. What? I sigh. That fella's name was Bill. Bob was the other one. And you're a white woman now. So don't get your knickers in a twist whenever someone says something about Negroes. You're supposed to enjoy talking down to colored folks. Catherine stops and puts her hands on her hips. I pause as well, half-turning toward her. Her lips are pursed with displeasure. How on earth am I supposed to live a lie? One that will surely end up with me dead if anyone discovers the truth. I don't say anything because she's right. A couple of years ago, a Baltimore shopkeeper named Rusty Barnes was discovered to be a Negro who'd been passing as a white man. A mob looted his shop and burned it to the ground. They would have killed Rusty as well if Jackson and I hadn't managed to sneak him out of the county. There's nothing white folks hate more than realizing they accidentally treated a Negro like a person. Well, I say, after a long pause, you let me worry about that. We're in this together, whether you like it or not. Catherine rolls her eyes, but she keeps up with me when I start walking again. Time to change the subject. I ever tell you about the garden back at Rose Hill? Catherine shades her eyes as she looks at me. Jane, what are you going on about? I pull Catherine up into the shade of the boardwalk. The church is just across the street, a white picket fence setting it off from the rest of the town. Back at Rose Hill, Auntie Aggie, that was the woman that mostly raised me, we'll plant a huge garden full of okra and carrots and cabbage, green beans and black-eyed peas, everything you needed to feed a plantation full of hungry people. Everyone had to work the garden at least a couple of times a week if they wanted to eat good. And even my mama would put on her big sun hat and go out and pull weeds. It was a necessity in a place where a trip beyond the barrier fence to the market could mean death. One summer, the garden was plagued by a rabbit. And this wasn't no ordinary rabbit. This was a hare of unnatural ability. It would always find a way inside of the fencing, filling itself up on the fruits of our labor.
It was, as Mama said, a bastard of a rabbit. Catherine gasps and looks around.
Jane, such language.
Let me finish my story. Anyway, Auntie Aggie and a few of the boys put out snares and traps galore. Everything from crates baited with carrots and bits of lettuce to complicated tie snares I found in an old frontiersman's book Mama had from her dead daddy. Nothing worked. Every morning we'd go out and see the parsley munched down to nubs or nibbles in the cabbage. The frustration was enough to put one off of gardening altogether, truth be told. But Auntie Aggie never let it faze her. Every night she would set out the same kind of snare, a simple loop knot that someone had taught her long ago. And every morning when the rabbit wasn't caught, she'd retie that snare, same as she did the day before. I asked her once if she was scared the hare was going to eat the whole garden clean before that trap of hers caught him. Jane, she said, look at this garden. Look at the lettuces and those beans. And those tomatoes? They are especially fine this year, don't you agree? Trust me on this, it's just nature for creatures like him to get greedy. That was all she said to me. Catherine's listening now, her eyes narrowed.
So what happened?
I grin. She was right. After nearly 2 weeks of trying to catch the hare, Aunt Aggie made us a nice rabbit stew from that fat bunny. See, while the rabbit was skinny and hungry, that snare couldn't catch him, and he was cautious enough to avoid it. But once he got fat, he couldn't fit through the same holes he used to. I ain't lying when I say he was big enough to feed darn near all of Rose Hill that night. And tasty? Well, all of his good eating meant even better eating for us. The point is, sometimes when the rabbit gets too fat, too comfortable, he makes mistakes. But the gardener, she ain't got nothing but time, because even the hungriest rabbit can't eat the entire garden. At some point, the good sheriff will make a mistake, some gross miscalculation, reveal some weakness, and that's when we'll find our freedom. Catherine is nodding now, her expression thoughtful.
We will be patient gardeners.
Yes, we will be the most patient gardeners, and we will fatten up that bunny like nobody's business. And when that rabbit is nice and plump, we shall set the snare and let him run right on through it. Catherine nods.
Thank you, Jane.
I smile because I'm relieved that she didn't ask the question I've been dreading since we got here. What if we're not the gardeners, but the rabbits? One of the biggest challenges here at Rose Hill is boredom and making sure that the people here don't fall into vice. Chapter 20, in which I meet a questionable man of God and a kind madam. Summerland's church is bigger than I expect. I've only seen a handful of folks walking around the town, but the church is easily the size of the First Baptist, the second largest church in Baltimore. While the rest of the town looks ragged and tired, the lone house of worship is fresh and clean. The building's walls are crisp with whitewash, and a real stained glass window is set high in the front of the building. The only similarity between the rest of the town and the church is the small windows covered with iron bars. But the shambler proofing is barely noticeable on such an impressive building. We walk up the path in silence, and before we can reach for the door, it swings open. The whitest white man I ever saw beckons us. His blue-veined hands shaky, his false teeth overly large in his mouth.
Miss Devereaux, please. Join me inside. The sun is frightful fierce today.
Catherine gives the man a beatific smile.
Sir, your kindness is greatly appreciated. Oh, I fear what this sun is going to do to my complexion. I can already feel a powerful flush coming upon me.
She sweeps inside the church and the cool darkness beyond the threshold. I make to follow her, but the old man stops me with a hard look.
I'm sorry, but it's our way here that those bearing the curse of Ham don't enter the church.
I scowl. The curse of Ham? I ain't never heard of such a thing, and I have a feeling it's got nothing to do with supper. Catherine sighs softly from behind the old man. It's a euphemism for the curse Noah put upon Canaan, Ham's son. It's the reason the Negro was enslaved, she says. There's a tightness in her voice that reveals she doesn't agree with this particular line of thinking, but the old white man doesn't notice. He nods in agreement with Catherine's explanation.
In these days of his castigation upon the earth, we must reaffirm the hierarchy of his creation and his will. Your soul will be cleansed in heaven. In the meantime, your kind are made to serve his image through toil and labor, girl.
What part of the scripture is that from? I mutter. The old man either doesn't hear me or chooses to ignore me.
Your mistress won't have use of you any longer. Here in Summerland, we take care of our blossoms the way the Lord has always intended. We have no need for attendant companions to live alongside our fair blossoms, no matter what Mayor Carr has instituted in those heathen cities of the East. Here, we have worked to reestablish the Lord's natural order, and peace and safety has been our reward. You'll serve the patrols. Take yourself to the House of Soiled Doves. The Duchess will take care of you.
With a vacant smile, he closes the door in my face. I stand there for a few moments, sweating, arms piled high with boots and clothing. I consider kicking in the door, but then what? I don't know how anything works around here, and I have nowhere to go. So I turn around and go back the way I came, toward the house of ill repute. When I reach the end of the boardwalk, I keep walking past the saloon and back toward the rail yard where we enter town. For a moment, I think that maybe I could just keep walking, out toward the mystery of the wall, past that to the open prairie, continue moving until I've left this whole mess behind. Running away has never been my style. But it doesn't seem so bad now. The road past the rail yard is lined with poles, and beyond it are houses, which I can get a better look at now. Beautiful houses, whitewashed and large, the kind of house where you could raise a nice family. Screams filter up the road from the houses, and I tense until I see a pack of kids come running around the side of one of them, playing some game of chase and laughing in between their proclamations of mock terror. The sight stops me in my tracks. When was the last time I saw kids running and playing, not a care in the world? Even back on Rose Hill, we tended to be cautious in our play, the memory of Zeke casting a long shadow for years to follow. If kids can run and play and scream in delight, then maybe Summerland ain't all bad. I turn back the way I came and head to the saloon. As I walk, I think of what Miss Preston said, that Catherine came from a brothel, and wonder if that's why she has such pretty manners. Even now, in the midst of a full-fledged crisis, Catherine has managed to retain her deportment. I grew up in the big house on Rose Hill, and even I didn't have manners as pretty as Catherine's when I got to Miss Preston's. I figured she'd grown up someplace where appearances would be important, but not a cat house. Of course, everything I know about brothels I know about from books. I read a novel, The Captain's Forbidden Woman, that was all about a poor girl named Annabelle who ended up as a working girl after her father's rival ruined her family. She was eventually rescued by a dashing ship's captain. I think Jackson got it to scandalize me, since the red velvet cover was decidedly lurid. but it ended up being a very good story. Annabelle spent many paragraphs relating the extravagant furnishings and decorum of the brothel. It all sounded very glamorous, although the idea of tossing up my skirts